but the quality is very poor. I'll play a little bit in a moment, but she says she kept her husband alive by hand-feeding him with a glass pipette. She kept him going for as long as possible. She made it her mission. They were both Catholic, and suicide is a mortal sin. It was the least she could do for another human being, even if he wasn't a terribly nice human being. Here is some of the tape. Forgive the quality. The sound was crackled and muffled and scratchy, and Dana Webb's aging voice, high and breathless. Her Boston accent sounded like a Kennedy parody. "No," she said, answering a mumbled off-mic question. "No, Mr. Webb was not a nice man. He was an all-round louse. God forgive me for speaking ill of the dead. May God rest his soul." She sounded as if the benevolent prayer was being punched out of her. Eventually, a bank took possession of the yacht in lieu of loan payments. Then the bank went bust. The Dana's title was contestable. Everyone knew that. So the beautiful ship languished in a shipyard, waiting for someone to take a chance on her. The Dana had a series of owners, 7 over a 6-year period, all of whom tried and failed to use her for profit. Then she was bought by a Parisian family, who used her for a happy few years of family holidays and pleasure sailing. In 1939, she sailed to Bermuda to overwinter. No one ever came back for her. The French family had evaporated during the liberation of Paris. By 1947, the Dana was impounded for mooring fees. Then the Danish government owned her, using long sea journeys as a form of drug rehab, but the ship was too expensive to maintain. Eventually, the Polish millionaire and playboy Andrus Larkos bought her, and so began the darkest episode in the yacht's history. Larkos spent a fortune renovating her, and then hosted lavish parties on board, hung priceless artworks in the dining room, served cocaine from a punch bowl. But that was when he was alone with his friends. The ship was stripped back when his 5 children and wife boarded for their annual holiday. The events that would make her famous happened on the 7th of July, 1976, coincidentally the same day and month in which she sank with the Parkers on board 40 years later. The Dana was docked in Crete during a stultifying heatwave. The cabins were unbearably hot and airless, so cots had been set up on deck. Larkos's 5 sons were asleep next to their nannies. The deck was a lake of white sheets. At 3:15 that night, one of the nannies was awoken by a deep, sonorous vibration through the hull. It was rhythmic. Thunk, 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 thunk. Something was banging against the side of the boat. She pulled back her sheet and padded over to the side. One of the Larkos boys was face down in the water. His head was being washed against the side of the boat by the lapping waves. Thunk, thunk. The boy was 7. It was a terrible accident. His mother, Angelica Larkos, had never had good mental health, but she broke down completely afterwards. She tried to cut her own throat and was admitted to a sanatorium. Diagnosed with a schizotypal disorder, she stayed there for the rest of her life. Andrus Larkos put the Dana up for sale, but unsurprisingly, no one wanted it. While he waited for a buyer, his other sons began to die. The press called it the Larkos curse. Hauntings, curses, and alien myths were fashionable in the 1970s. Human beings are programmed to find patterns, to make sense of random events, and back then, curses were a favoured explanation. The modern equivalent might be conspiracy theories. Looked at objectively, there was no mysterious supernatural force causing the deaths of the Larkos boys. because this was far from risk-free parenting. Andris did his best, but he took the boys to places where no child should be. They visited refugee camps. They were in the Sudan during a cholera outbreak. They were taken on a crazy 3-week free camping safari in Tanzania. One boy died when he fell from an open-sided helicopter in Miami and broke his back. Another died from an overdose of barbiturates prescribed to the housekeeper. A third boy simply got lost on the slopes of Kilimanjaro. No trace of him was ever found. With only one son surviving, Andrew sold the Dana dirt cheap to a Mr. and Mrs. Clark. This was when the public myth of the Dana really began. The Clarks were publicity hounds. Soon they were all over the papers, claiming that the Dana was haunted. The ghost sightings were always the same. In the middle of the night, a small boy would be seen standing on the edge of the prow, his hair and clothes dripping wet. I was really only listening for more mentions of Gretchen Tiegler, and was slow to realise that the boy with the angry black eyes in the Divers film was somehow related to this part of the story. One man who saw the ghost was a crewman from Malta. He told the story to a journalist from RTE. It cut to a radio interview. The man's accent was a cross between Blitzy to London and Southern Italy. His voice was soft.
"The middle of the night. We were maybe 200 feet from dock. I was on deck, alone, and I see a boy standing on the prow, a small boy. He's silhouetted by moonlight reflected from the sea. I stop. I stare at the boy. I blink, but the boy is still there. A boy? What? I approached him and I said, 'Hello?' But the boy didn't answer me. I asked the boy, 'Is your father on board?' The boy looked up. He didn't look at me, just sort of up. Then the boy speaks. His voice is clear, but his lips don't move. He says, 'Lotto Vadi.' But that boy didn't look like a ghost in a film. He isn't see-through or floating around or anything. No, he's just a sad, wet boy, lost in the night. So, I am wondering, how does a boy get on a boat in the night? Well, he could not have come here tonight. He must have been here all along. Maybe a member of the crew has smuggled their child on board with them. Many of us, we're unemployed fishermen, paid only on the end of a voyage, no upfront payment, no banks, so can't send money home. What do you do with the children? So maybe someone has no family to leave their child with and they bring him and hide him on board. Maybe? I don't know. Anyway, I can see he is close to the edge. He is upset, and I know I should get him away from there. I hold my hand out. This boy doesn't move or look up. 'Lotto,' I say. He was singing in a gentle, coaxing voice. 'Lotto, my dear, take my hand, please.' And I stepped towards the boy. We are close to the edge. I glance down for a split second to check my steps. I glance back up and, what? That boy is gone. I run to the edge and look over. Nothing. I am in a panic, very frightened. Where is this boy? I was a young man and didn't know what to do, so I wake the rest of the crew and ask, 'Who brought this little kid on board? A boy called Lotto Vadi?' I describe him. The crew, they laughed at me. I am seeing things. Maybe there is a gas leak next to my bunk. The captain comes down and hears what happened. 'I am Maltese. I speak Maltese, English and Italian. Little Spanish, some Turkish. But I didn't speak Polish. The captain speaks Polish. He say, Lotovadi is Polish. It is not a boy's name. It means icy cold. There was a pause before Trina Kini came back on to speak. This story became an urban myth. It was told in occultist magazines and around campfires. A journalist with an eye for a moneymaker contacted the clerks and convinced them that he could write a book about it. They agreed. A contract was drawn up, they got a publishing deal, but there wasn't enough to fill a book. Someone thought they saw a boy. A boy had died. There were odd sounds and strange smells. Sinister, but it made no narrative sense. So one night, the clerks and the journalist met in a London hotel room, got drunk, and hashed out a proper story. In this new version, Angelica Larkos was the mother of 7 boys, not 5. She is still alive, remember, when this book comes out. No one fact-checked anything at the time. The night before her marriage to Andris, she had held a séance with her sisters. This was all totally made up by the clerks and their co-author. In the fictional séance, Angelica became possessed by an ancient Polish demon called a bies, the same demon that had possessed her recently deceased grandmother. In Polish folklore, bies are demons who bring terror and dread to those around them. They rob the free will from those they possess, use them as slaves until the person's mind cannot take any more, and they break down, never to recover. Bies suck the life force from people around them, take their warmth, hence they are always accompanied by an abrupt drop in temperature. It's the sort of cold that starts inside and worms its way to the skin. Bies possess a person by degrees, so the person can appear normal for long periods of time, until suddenly, without warning, they push you off a bridge, burn your house down, attack a stranger. Perhaps the most brutal aspect of a bies possession is those periods when the person is aware of the terrible things they have done. Like a lot of folklore, this has some basis in fact. Angelica's family have a history of schizophrenia. Bies possession may have been a useful explanation at a time when schizophrenia was little understood. In the Clark's story, Angelica's possession was intermittent over the first few years of her marriage. The demon was waiting for the birth of her 7th child. As an aside, the numbers 3 and 7 feature prominently in all world religions and many myths and legends. The significance of the 7th child was supposed to be that the power of the bies would be stronger or transferable to a 7th child. But honestly, the theology of the haunting of the Dana hasn't been thought out terribly well. They were drinking and in a hurry to meet their publishing deadline. According to the new version of the story, Angelica knew what was happening and tried to warn her husband, her mother, her other sons, but she wasn't believed. She was sent to a sanatorium and couldn't protect her 7th son. So her 7th son, in his 7th year, became possessed and was lured to the side of the Dana and drowned. Ever since then, malevolent bies have lingered on the Dana, using the ghost boy as bait for souls to feed on. The book had a creepy cover design of a small boy silhouetted on the prow of the Dana, seen from the deck. It was so famous at the time that it was parodied by Saturday Night Live. The book sold millions worldwide. Amid much fanfare, a movie company bought the film rights and the Dana itself, which they used as a promotional device. The movie was very successful. The Exorcist, The Omen and The Amityville Horror had been smash hits, and The Haunting of the Dana seemed to ride the tail of the occult movie craze. A sequel followed, The Dana 2. Then, a decade later, a low-budget reboot, Dana: The Revenge. But interest had faded.
The yacht was put up for sale. Anyone who could afford a private yacht wanted one that wasn't famous for being in crappy horror movies, and the Dana attracted ghoulish attention wherever it docked, which defeats the purpose of having a private yacht. This was why Leon Parker managed to buy it so cheap and in perfect condition. The reputation of the Dana coloured all of the subsequent coverage when it sank. In the next episode, we will look at the chronology of the story breaking and how it became an international obsession. Are you keen to cook fresh, nutritious meals that will invigorate you? Find yourself too busy? Why not try Fast and Fresh? We were on the outskirts of Glasgow, approaching the high, dark hills framing Loch Lomond. We still had a long way to go. I wanted to see my friend Adam Ross again. I wanted to ask him about working as crew on a private yacht. Mostly I just wanted to see someone I didn't have to lie to. I thought Finn had fallen asleep. I was still nervous about driving and didn't dare glance away from the road. His breathing was shallow. He wasn't moving. I picked up my phone, found the next episode, and pressed play. Chapter 16. Episode 4. How the story broke. Initially, the sinking of the Dana attracted little attention. A footnote in Le Figaro, a smaller bit in the Daily Echo, Leon's local paper in Southampton. It was just a boating accident, a misadventure. The circumstances were strange, but no one suspected foul play. In Mark Parker's Instagrammed post, they were all holding glasses of champagne. They were drinking. Drunk kids, big boat, indulgent father. Sailing is dangerous. It was the order of events, the way it unfolded, that made the story what it became. The insurance company, expecting a big claim from Leon's widow, initiated a sonar investigation of the seabed. They found the wreck of the Dana 40 yards underwater, jammed upright against a rock. In fact, the insurance claim was never made. Gretchen Tiegler never did submit a claim. That seems strange. She has a staff, it was a debt. It would be usual to ask for payment as a matter of course. Anyway, towards the end of the summer, while the sea was still diveable, the company sent a team down to film the wreck, hoping to find the cause of the accident, but something went very wrong. The diver adopted a course of action no seasoned professional would. He deviated from the dive plan, went inside, ran out of oxygen, and died down there. The film he live-streamed to the surface vessel was reviewed by investigators. It was very disturbing. What they saw made no logical sense. I recalled the sensation of watching the film in the dark hall, my mood low, my blood syrupy, the mounting tension of the film and its shock ending defibrillating me back into the world. Trina Keeney continued. In the insurance film, the diver dies after finding what is left of the Parker family sitting in the dining room at the table. The change in atmospheric pressure when the diver opens the door makes it look as if the dead bodies are trying to stand up from the table. The diamond necklace is gone from Violetta's body. She is no longer wearing it, though the box is discernible in the shadows, sitting on the table, open and empty. There is a general agreement that the antique necklace fastening might have rotted in the salt water, and the necklace could have fallen off and been buried in the detritus on the floor. But the final image on the diver's film shows a boy's face. It seems to materialise out of the darkness and flashes a light at him. The face looks like the boy from the film, The Haunting of the Dana. It's all very weird and very creepy. Someone leaked the film online and it went viral. If you haven't already watched it, I would suggest you don't. It's upsetting. It features dead bodies in a state of decay, and you don't need to see it for this podcast to make sense. I have friends and family in the States. Talking to them after 9/11, it was clear that they did not see the footage of people leaping from the Twin Towers that we in the UK did. They didn't see people at windows, their faceless courage, the shirts flapping. This is because broadcasters conspired not to show it, and they did that on compassionate grounds. That decision could not be made now. There are too many outlets, but it did happen back then, and they were right to do it. There are things that should not be seen. For me, this film is one of them. But how did a boy get into the film? I think the image has been altered for hits. Someone pasted the picture into the movie. The question is, why would anyone do that? Why would someone go to the trouble of elaborately doctoring an insurance film to make it more frightening? Not for money. There was no paywall on the film when it was leaked. Not for fame either, because the source of the leak never came forward. This is a sub-thread mystery. Why didn't they come forward? Did they do it as a joke for a friend in the office and they leaked it? If so, I think they must have realised they would get into a lot of trouble for it. It showed actual dead people in an inappropriate way. They disrespectfully edited a film of dead people, and they might never work in the insurance industry again if their identities were known. It damaged the insurance company's reputation for professional confidentiality, and they could have sued and ruined whoever was responsible. Other people say the image of the boy couldn't have been pasted in. Bits of paper and silt can be seen moving in front of the image. Also, the diver seems to react to the boy's face being there. It's the boy that makes him panic and scramble for the exit. This is the problem with speculation. It's unsatisfying. We want clean answers and better stories than maybe this, possibly that. Real life often makes no sense. So, a cleaner, more definitive story took hold in the popular imagination. The vengeful spirit of the Polish boy who haunted the Dana had killed the Parker family and lured the diver to his death. BS believers argue that the diver was hypnotized by the ghost when he approached the ship, was tricked into entering the cabin, and fed the BS demon with his fear and his death. This was a film of an actual ghost, and anyone who denied it was conspiring to suppress that. Deniers were actually working for the BS. Isn't that better than, I think someone may have pasted this in for a joke? All the different theories found their congregations. Facebook groups and Reddit threads formed. They split into cliques. Armed with nothing but their conviction, some formed posses and took direct action, gathering in Saint Martin to look for clues. Illegal dive expeditions were broken up by the Coast Guard. Ghost tours were running out to the wreck site, incredibly dangerous given its proximity to a major shipping lane. Locals hated it. Remember, this is a very exclusive holiday resort. The town of Saint Martin was full of bungling citizen detectives and news crews, each trying to prove what they already believed. Restaurants and cafes in the town put signs in their windows saying they would not answer questions about the Parkers. Please refer all inquiries to the police. Violetta's hotel posted a notice saying that they had returned all of her belongings to her mother because Dana tourists were trying to bribe staff for mementos. If you go to Saint Martin, as I have, you'll find that the locals won't talk about it anymore. As soon as you say Dana, they ask you to leave. The French police investigation was a mess. Driven by headlines and hysteria, the investigation took routes that seemed bizarre in the cold light of day. One police press conference centered on a discussion of whether or not ghosts really existed. In fact, there are rational explanations for everything. The diver was not hypnotized by a ghost, but he might have been offered a bonus if he retrieved the diamond necklace. That could be why he went in there. Even if he wasn't offered a bonus, he may have seen the Instagrammed picture, assumed that if he found Violetta's body, he would find a necklace worth 750,000 euros. Unofficial salvaging is not that unusual, and professional divers with a lot of experience sometimes take risks no one else would. They trust their experience to assess difficult situations. The story doesn't need the supernatural to make sense. To diffuse all of the hysteria over the film, the insurance company hired Olaf Taskson, the famous diving expert, to do a commentary and explain to audiences what they were actually seeing. Not corpses standing up to greet the damned, but a change in cabin pressure. Not a diver possessed by a BS demon, but an overconfident professional taking too many chances. The second version of the film, with Taskson's commentary, was released only 3 weeks later, but got a fraction of the views for the first one. The world had already decided which version of the story they liked best. Taskson's version is the one we have on our website. Personally, I would not urge you to watch that either.
Do you always mean to cook fresh meals from scratch?
I switched it off. Have you seen that film? Finn said nothing, but made an odd snuffling sound through his nose. I wanted to glance at him, but we were on a dark, fast road, skirting the side of Loch Lomond. Giant hills loomed over the still, black water. I was unsure of my driving, and the car behind me was too close for me to slow down. Their headlights were reflected in my rear-view mirror, blinding me to distance. I slowed, and they slowed. They wouldn't overtake, but just stayed too close.
Finn, I need you to answer me so I know you're okay.
I heard his dry mouth make a schlack sound as it opened and he said,
Okay.
He sounded groggy. Finn, have you taken something?
Nah.
His voice was faint.
I'm not well.
I don't know anything about anorexia, except that it's dangerous. A famous man needing resuscitation in a car I was driving with a stolen ID was a complication too far today. Without the skills to drive well, I took a turn at a sign for a restaurant too quickly, flattening Finn to the window. I knew he wasn't dying because his hands flew up in alarm. Chapter 17. The restaurant was a big corrugated iron shed, painted black. The car park was empty, but the lights were on inside. The place was open. I parked near the door.
Look, Finn, you're not well enough to travel. I'm going to drop you here and you can get a taxi home.
He looked despairingly at the rain pattering softly on the windscreen and raised a weak hand.
You're too fragile, Finn. It's another 100 miles to Fort William.
I'm okay.
You haven't spoken for 40 minutes.
He looked at me with cold-eyed fury.
It hasn't been the best day.
Oh, really? Well, I've had a lovely day. I'm glad you came to my home to saddle me with looking after you because my day's been a non-stop fucking fiesta.
This was said with a lack of warmth and excessive volume. I got out of the car and slammed the door. I was shaking. He got out of the car. We stood in the rain on either side of the car. I half thought that he'd come round and would have a punch-up. Or was I hoping for a punch-up? Those two things often feel the same. But that isn't what happened. He walked round the bonnet, heading into the restaurant. I locked the car and followed him. Inside it was an assault on all the senses. The room smelled of Christmas cake and floor cleaner. The carpet was tartan and the walls were covered in stag heads, whiskey posters and swords. Fiddle music jangled around the metal room with manic cheer. The staff were all dressed in kilts and Aran jumpers, but they were young and you could still see who they really were underneath. The tattoos and piercings, shaved undercuts and pink and blue hair. We were the only customers, but they were expecting a coachload. Two long tables were set, and 10 members of staff were idling by the bar. The waiter showed us to a table up on a wooden platform. A shield and claymore sword decoration loomed on the wall above us. The menus were laminated. Haggis. That was the menu. Haggis burger, haggis stew, haggis pakora, tempura, even soup. Let me say, no one in Scotland eats haggis without a sense of irony. It's one of the things I like about the place. Anyone eating the national dish will tell you, I'm eating haggis. French people do the same with frog's legs. People claim to love haggis, or the veggie version, which is a nut roast and nothing at all to do with haggis. But it's not a staple. It's tourist food for special occasions. The waiter shrugged at the menu.
We do have proper food, like chicken and that.
I looked at Finn. He was frowning intently at the menu. I ordered two chicken things and water to drink. The waiter stared at Finn.
You're him, aren't you?
It took Finn a minute to look up.
What? Oh, I just saw you trending on Twitter there, so I knew it was you.
He nodded at the rest of the staff sitting in a huddle around the bar.
Can I get a selfie?
Finn obliged, smiling warmly, but his smile dropped as soon as the flash was done.
We'll leave you alone, said the waiter. Don't worry.
He took the menus and walked away. Finn had left his phone in the car and asked to borrow mine. I gave it to him. He Googled himself. His expression, uplit in the dark restaurant, shifted swiftly from furious to calm. He scrolled down, and a confused smile warmed his face. His eyebrows rose slowly. He was sucked into the face of the phone and lost to me. I looked around for a bit, but there wasn't much to look at. Tourist tat and teenagers whispering about Finn at the side of the bar. I picked up some brochures from the menu stand and read one about boat trips and another about an aquarium. Finn was still scrolling, his face very animated, having more of an interaction with the comments about himself than he had with me in nearly an hour of driving. He looked worried. What is it? I asked finally.
Your neighbour tweeted a picture of me on the steps outside your house, and the Proannas are saying I look great, which is worrying. I should eat something.
What's Proannas?
Pro-anorexia. He looked ashamed. I have anorexia. I struggle. The pro-mob encourage it. They're kind of poisonous. I feel I'm endorsing them if I don't stay well. It's too much pressure. I've been on hiatus from social media recently.
He seemed pleased, though, revived, as if the world talking about him had breathed new life into him. The food arrived. The chicken thing was unexpectedly fantastic. It was slow roasted and served with a creamy smoked garlic sauce and buttery celeriac mash. I hadn't eaten all day and got lost in the interplay of flavours, sharp and soft, pleasing textures and a lingering tang of smoke on the back of my tongue. I considered the tragedy of a chef this talented stuck microwaving haggis out here in the middle of rainy nowhere. I looked up. Cohen was not eating. He sat, hands on his lap, looking at the plate of lovely food as if it had offended him. Eat it? It's delicious.
I can't eat that, he said to the plate. I'm vegan.
Eat around it then, I said, or eat something else. I don't care what it is. Have some bread and butter. I knew it was stupid as soon as I said it. For fuck's sake, you're an adult. You can find food in a restaurant. Finn critically examined the side salad, lifting leaves with his fork and looking underneath for sides of beef secreted under the lettuce. He found the salad acceptable, actually giving it a little nod. Then he pushed the exquisite chicken dish away across the table, infuriatingly slowly. He pulled the tiny salad plate in front of him and began scooping mini morsels up on his fork, grimacing as he put them in his mouth. It was painful to watch. Finn, did you pass out in the car?
It's just low blood sugar. When I haven't eaten for a while, I get a bit dizzy.
You passed out? What if that happens in the street? How would anyone know what to do for you?
I carry my passport, my doctor's number and a note about my blood sugar.
He had a strategy for passing out and didn't seem to realise how bizarre that was. I pointed at his figure. No margin of error on you, is there? He glared at me. I didn't understand why everything I said about food was wrong. Okay, I said, eat that and a pudding and I won't leave you here. He put his fork down and glared at me.
That is what you don't say.
What?
Talk about my body shape, try to blackmail me to eat. If someone has an eating problem, you're supposed to encourage...
Son, eat if you want to get back in my fucking car. He froze. I could see from his face that he'd been told bad things about me, doubted them, but now believed them to be true.
Why did you drag me here?
I smiled. Finley, do you think I'm stupid? I've got two kids. He was very offended.
I've heard you were aggressive.
My girls are better at this than you.
At what?
Starting fights so they don't have to eat their dinner. I'm not looking after you. Eat or stay. Your choice. I don't give a fuck either way. We sat and ate furiously at each other, silently formulating insults and reproaches in time to the jig music swirling overhead. I knew there was a train station in Crian Larach, not 10 miles up the road. I could drop him there and he'd be back in Glasgow in an hour. I'd be free of him. But he wasn't dressed for standing on a concrete train platform in November. I was sure he'd fainted in the car. And if he did that again, alone on an exposed train platform, he wouldn't be found until the next day. He could easily die of hypothermia. My phone buzzed on his side of the table, and he handed it to me. A text from Jess's phone.
Arrived safe and sound. Hotel nice and clean. Had a sensible dinner. Love from Jess and Lizzie.
I texted back. I'd actually rather hear it from Jess herself, thanks, Estelle. Can you give her the phone back, please? Didn't even use punctuation. Fuck her.
Hi, Mum. It's nice hotel. We're fine. JJ, kiss, kiss, kiss.
My heart leapt and fell. Definitely from her. I texted back. That's super. All okay here. Do try to have a nice time and take photos. Sleep well, darlings. I'm only a few hours away if you need me. Mum. Kisses.
Okay.
Then an emoji of a swimmer. I desperately wanted to hear more but didn't text a prompt. They should be in bed by now. I scrolled up through the old texts from her. She wasn't allowed to take the phone out of the house, it was just for play. I was looking for one that was more satisfying, longer and about anything.
There really weren't any.
The waiter came up to the table with an oval dish and spoke to Finn. The chef had made a vegan stir fry. He hoped Finn didn't mind. They weren't going to charge us, and the chef said it was his pleasure. He wasn't busy. He was trying out new dishes. They chatted about veganism. For an anorexic being presented with a second dinner, Cohen was very gracious. He tasted it and said it was delicious, really amazing, and asked to meet the chef. The waiter brought him out. He was pasty and young, with a shaved head and tumbling dice tattooed on his neck. Sweating with excitement, he chatted to Finn and said he was vegan too, or wanted to be vegan. I didn't listen. I don't understand why people monologue about what they don't want to eat as if it's interesting. They were chit-chatting. The chef asked for a selfie too, and it didn't include me. I busied myself on the phone, looking at the pictures on the Death and the Dana page. Photo for EP3. Harold J. Webb stood alone in a New York street. He was short, had a walrus moustache, and was dressed in a grey morning suit, matching bowler hat, holding a silver-topped cane. He glared into the lens, his irascibility still crisp 90 years on. Photo for EP5. A black-and-white dotted image from a newspaper article. A woman had been surprised by a photographer. Two uniformed policemen held her arms tight, and her hair swung out to the side. She had been yanked round to face the camera and was slack-jawed, wide-eyed with a slight double chin. Her hair was cut into a rough mullet. The photographer was standing too close and the flash had bleached out her eyebrows, emphasising her heavy brow, making her look Neanderthal. Was that Amila? No. The picture looked too old, was black and white. We hadn't got to that bit yet. Photo for EPSIX. Gretchen Tiegler. This was a paparazzi snap from a while ago. She was walking along a sunny street looking bland and unremarkable in the beige uniform of American money. White sweater, slacks, clothes that flatter no one but denote membership as clearly as a gang tattoo. Her square face was framed by helmety blonde hair, sunglasses worn as a hairband. A chubby personal assistant walked behind her, carrying shopping bags. In the manner of dedicated PAs, she was dressed in an off-echo of her boss. Same hair, cheaper sweater. She was looking at the back of Gretchen's head as if trying to anticipate her next thought. Dauphine Loire. Dauphine Loire had once taken out a contract on me. I'd never seen a photo of her before. She didn't look murderous. She looked a bit nervous and very focused on Gretchen Tiegler. I saw PAs like that at Skibo. They were often codependents who found a colleague that matched their condition, pandering to the unappeasable, working for little, defending with their lives. I found them a bit pathetic, but Adam Ross pointed out that they often seemed happier than the wives or the children. I knew that it would have been Gretchen who decided that the investigation should focus on Amila. I didn't believe Leon would kill his kids, but was sure that Gretchen had decided who the official killer would be. This had her stamp all over it. Gretchen's motive always bothered me. She couldn't be a villain because they don't exist. No one got up in the morning rubbing their hands as they looked forward to a day of doing evil. She must have had some justification for the terrible, terrible things she had done. Everyone was too afraid to stop her or speak out. The press colluded, the cops went along with her, and if that didn't get her the outcome she wanted, she sent the heavies in. I went back to the podcast homepage and looked at the picture of Leon and his kids again. He was happy then, just before. You could see it in his eyes. At least he had that. Looking at his picture made me want a cigarette and a warm night and a good friend to laugh and tell stories with. I made myself close it and go to Twitter, open on the comments below the picture of Finn. Pretcher would be thrilled. Her pic had 12,000-ish likes and a lot of retweets. People were pleased to see that the rumours of his death were untrue. Where had he been? Too thin, Finn. Looking sleek. I scrolled back up to Pretcher's photo. It wasn't a picture of Finn Cohen outside my house. It was a picture of me and Finn Cohen outside my house, a clear, sharp picture of my face with my scar visible. It cuts across my eyebrow. It is thin and white. It's distinctive. The modern mania for photographs is hard on those in hiding. If you have a friend with a thin backstory who always wants to take the picture or slides behind the heads of others in group snaps, be kind to them. Camera phones are a bloody menace. A little nervous, I scrolled down. There were exclamations of love for Finn, emojis, anorexia talk, and then, quite far down, I hit a comment saying things I hadn't heard for a long time. My real name, and a link to my story. 10 Finn comments further down, a gif of a dead cat nailed to my old front door. Oh, God. My girls. That was my first thought. Not that I was in danger, but that my lovely, unspoiled girls would find out about me. I followed the link to an article about the case. It was 8 years old, from a year after I had run. I'd read it before. It was about the other girl being found dead in a suspicious house fire while living under an assumed name. They mentioned my court case. I'd read it on the front page of a newspaper at the time, too afraid to even buy the paper. That was why I'd stayed away. Fuck. I felt sick. I felt ashamed. I was shaking. I leaned over the table, vinegar tears dripping into the creamy smears of sauce on my plate. The smell of garlic hit my nose and made me gag. My girls would hear what they did to me. Jig music jangled above my head, chit-chat jabbed at my ears. On Twitter, an emoji avatar told someone else to ring the police. They were trying to work out which city Finn Cohen lived in. Pretcher hadn't geotagged the photo, but it wouldn't take them long to find out. A stranger told another stranger what should be done to me to teach me not to lie. 80 likes. Finn better watch himself with a lying bitch like me. Someone with an avatar of the football club's logo said they could find me. Someone else said they would help. They decided to DM each other and dropped off the thread. The next comment was, "Wow, Finn, so thin. Thumbs up from Japan." "I need to go." Finn looked away from his adoring vegan chef and spoke very slowly.
"I haven't finished eating yet."
"Box it up or stay," I said, and got up, dropped money on the table, and hurried back out to the car. Chapter 18. I drove.
"What is going on?"
asked Finn. I couldn't talk. I couldn't look at him. I just drove, thinking about the other girl. I knew they'd killed her. Gretchen Tiegler killed her. I didn't feel sad about it at the time. I'd assumed she had everything I didn't have. Support, family, resources, courage. I lived. She died. End of story. I honestly hadn't given her a second thought.
"Anna, will you please tell me what's going on?"
I couldn't. I put the podcast back on. Episode 5. Emila Fabricasse, her famous mother, and the French obsession with bread. This episode is about how the French police investigating the sinking became obsessed with Emila Fabricasse to the point of charging her with 3 murders she couldn't possibly have committed. There are a number of ways of looking at this. The kindest is that Emila's story was so beguiling and unfolded so pleasingly that the French police couldn't resist it. A more sinister one is that it was to deflect attention from Gretchen Tiegler, who could be neither questioned nor crossed because she is so powerful. I couldn't believe Trina Keeney was saying these things. They were true, but everyone else knew better than calling out the Emperor. Was Keeney powerful too? Was she working for someone powerful? Was she stupid? If she was, she was in terrible danger. I wondered if she knew that. Perhaps at Gretchen's direction, the Dana's captain drew the focus to Emila again and again. He made public statements about Emila leaving. He gave interviews about her erratic behaviour on board. He hassled the police until they went to talk to her. But the captain had lost his ship while drinking in a bar with his crew, and he let Leon pay the crew cash in advance of the voyage. This made him seem feckless and unprofessional, especially to other sailors. Maybe that was why he was so keen to have it resolved. All of the police investigation centred on Emila and her story. But what a story. It's easy to see how they got sucked into the glamour, the death, the startling reveals. Emila's story was so compelling that a suicidal businessman must have seemed dreary by comparison. That's a benign explanation of how they overlooked all the other evidence of what happened on the Dana that night. So, who was Emila? Emila Fabricasse grew up in Lyon, a city obsessed with food. It is a city of restaurants and gastronomic theologians. It's where chefs go on holiday. The Lyonnais have loyalties to certain bakers and bouchons, the way other cities have football supporters. Chefs and bakers and cheesemakers are celebrities there, admired and recognised in the street, and she was an integral part of that scene. Emilia was a baker. She left school young and trained hard. She was known and admired for her traditional breads. She and her partner, Sabina, were planning to set up their own bakery, but neither of them came from money. They were still years away from raising their stake. This was used against her later. They said she was envious of the rich people she worked for, but aren't we all envious of rich people? Even rich people wish they were richer. To raise the startup money, Emilia worked as a chef on private yachts, and Sabina was a chef for a Swiss banker. 3 seasons later, they had saved a third of their stake. It was slow, but they were getting there. Emilia was 24, on the brink of a great career, when her headaches started. They came and went suddenly, in flurries. Her right eye would swell and tears would course down her cheeks. She developed a weak shoulder from tensing in her sleep, a disaster for a baker. Time was running out. Emilia saw her family doctor about the headaches before she set off on the Dana. He referred her to a specialist. She was tested for brain lesions and tumours. They found nothing. There was no known cause and therefore no treatment available, apart from painkillers so strong they were disabling. Emilia had to work an 18-hour day on board. She couldn't take them. She texted Sabina the day before they docked in San Martin and said the headaches were getting worse. She hadn't slept for days. Sabina texted back 2 words, "Come home." As we know, Emilia got off at San Martin. She took a taxi straight to La Rochelle Airport and waited for the next flight to Lyon. The Dana was heading out to sea as her plane lifted off from the runway. The Dutch container ship was watching it. By the time Emilia landed in Lyon, the Dana was under the water. She didn't go straight to the flat she shared with Sabina. She went to her grandmother's house, out in the countryside, because the doctor who was treating her was there. He gave her enough codeine to let her sleep for a full 8 hours. She was very weak. She hardly got out of bed for days. On the third morning, she was a little better, still groggy, but her grandmother was reassured enough to leave her alone in the house while she went shopping. Emilia would be in custody by the time she got back. The police came to the door and asked to interview her about the Dana. Emilia didn't know it had sunk. She welcomed them in, thinking that Violetta's diamond necklace had been stolen. She said Lyon was nice, but shouldn't have brought something that valuable onto a boat. She sympathised with the cops about having their time wasted. The police knew they were not there about the necklace, but they didn't tell her that. Emilia gave them permission to search her house, but asked them to be quick and finish before her grandmother came back. Her grandma was an old hippie and not entirely enamoured of the police. Emilia was about to find out why. The police were thorough. They didn't just look in necklace-shaped places, but read through papers and examined computers. Then they called in reinforcements. By the time Emilia's grandmother came back, the cops had a search warrant and brought in sniffer dogs. They began to break through walls and lift floorboards. They had found papers linking Emilia and her grandmother to a string of murders and robberies. They later found a small quantity of explosives buried under the floor of an outhouse on the periphery of the property. They had proof that Emilia Fabricasse's name had been changed from her birth name, Rosa Luxemburg Berghoff. Emilia was Rina Berghoff's daughter. Finn reached forward and paused the podcast.
Why are we listening to this?
My mind flooded with Gretchen Tiegler and house fires and rape threats from strangers. Put it back on!
Can we talk?
No, put it back on, Finn.
I'm not interested in this. I don't know who anyone is.
I'd have punched him unconscious if I wasn't driving. Put it back on!
Who is Amila?
Put the fucking thing back on!
He saw me slap tears off my cheeks. I was driving too fast on a narrow, winding road. We were skirting the edge of the deep loch, no more than a cliff edge away from the black water. Trees hung over the road, and the only lights were reflections from the road signs warning of sharp turns and cliffs and rockfalls.
You okay, Anna?
Please, put it on.
He put it back on. In 1986, Rena Berghoff was a debutante at a Swiss finishing school when her father, an undersecretary at the French embassy in West Berlin, died suddenly of a heart attack. She was 17. Rena came to Berlin for the funeral and never went back to school. One biographer later said she had left undercooked. Berlin was a hotbed of radicalism at the time, and Rena became involved with left-wing political groups. But she was a debutante, an aristocrat. There were rumours that she worked for the CIA, for the KGB, was doing an undercover investigation on leftist factions for Der Spiegel. No one trusted her. Rena didn't care. She wrote, "The eternal companions of all clever women are mistrust and scorn." Pretty astute for an 18-year-old. By the way, if you're ever in Berlin and you see a woman wearing a t-shirt with mistrust and scorn printed on it, that's what that is about. Arrogance didn't make Rena more popular. She became a hate figure to both left and right. She gave birth to a daughter, refused to name the father, and called the baby Rosa Luxemburg Berghoff. This was widely ridiculed as pompous and offensive. When the little girl was just one, Rena's politics spiralled out of control. An anti-apartheid demonstration outside the South African embassy turned violent and a driver was shot. His car was stolen and Rena and her faction were on the run. They formed a terrorist group, Resistance Direct, and committed a string of bank robberies, a murder, took an industrialist hostage, and brutally assaulted a German government minister. Their point was that the Nazis had never been purged from public life. They were still there, in high office. After 2 years on the run, they were all arrested in Hamburg. Women terrorists attract a particular kind of horror. Counter-terrorism officers regard them as more dangerous than men because they have often given up more, overcome more social conditioning to commit violent political acts, and officers generally train to avoid shooting women and children. While they waited in prison for the trial to begin, all of Rena's comrades committed suicide, hanging themselves one by one. Rena didn't. By the time of the trial, she was the only one left alive. The press characterized her as a succubus. The trial took place in a closed court. The press were excluded to stop her hijacking proceedings to speak to the world. The photograph you can see on our website was taken as she stepped from a police van on the first day of her hearing. Rena didn't know her trial was starting that day. She didn't know where she was being taken. The picture was released to the worldwide press. Found guilty at the trial, she was given 8 consecutive life sentences. She issued a statement through her lawyer. She wasn't sorry. She would do it all again. She didn't even mention having a daughter. Rena's mother cut all ties with her, secretly changed the baby's name to Amila Fabricasse, and moved to the house near Lyon. At least that was what she said. At Trevi, the precursor to Europol, some detectives were convinced that fringe members of Resistance Direct had hidden out in the Lyonnais farmhouse for months. They were watching the farmhouse until Amila was 7. Amila didn't know her name had been changed. She grew up believing her mother and father were surgeons who died in a car crash. The police found her real birth certificate taped to the underside of a drawer in her grandmother's office. Interpol confirmed their findings. The cops knew who she was before she did. France has draconian anti-terrorism laws. Emila was interviewed for 20 hours. She didn't really know what was going on. In transcripts of the interviews, she still thinks it is something to do with the diamond necklace. At this point, no one knew why the Dana sank. Emila's only real crime had been to leave the ship at a fortunate time. But she was well known in Lyon, and the local press called for her release. It was in response to this outcry that the cops leaked the Rena Berghoff connection and announced that they had found a package of explosives buried on the property with scraps of DNA on it that matched Emila's. Public sympathy evaporated. Only much later did they admit that the DNA of other members of Resistance Direct had been found on the package too, and the incomplete DNA may have been Rena Berghoff's. She was being held without charge until the police saw the wreck dive video and the hole blown in the bow. The damage came from inside the engine room, in an area where there shouldn't be anything combustible. To them, this was confirmation of the use of explosives. Emila came from a terrorist family. She had explosives on her property. When a narrative chimes with pre-existing beliefs, it can seem so self-evidently true that all conflicting evidence is discarded. Emila was charged with 3 counts of murder, among other things. She was tried under terrorism legislation in a closed court with lower evidentiary standards. They didn't even need to come up with a motive. It was just because of terrorism, that blank Scrabble tile that can mean anything at all. Despite her cast-iron alibi, no appeal was ever lodged. Only months after Emila's conviction, Sabina opened the bakery they had been saving up for. Where did that money come from? How did Emila turn off the Dana's radio and motor out of port and into the Atlantic when she was sitting in departures? How did she restrain the Parkers when she was in the air? It has been suggested that she used the disabling painkillers to poison the Parkers. This makes sense. It would explain why they were sitting passively in a stuffy dining room, not eating, with the door closed. But how could she administer the drugs? She couldn't have put anything toxic in the champagne. The bottle was opened after she left. She couldn't have poisoned the food. It arrived on board while she was in the airport. Remember, she didn't even know which restaurant the food was coming from. The captain arranged it while she was in the taxi to the airport. She couldn't have poisoned the plates or pots because she couldn't know what they would order. This crime could only have been committed by someone on board. The question the police never, ever asked was this. Did someone on board do it? Specifically, did Leon do it? Why was he never a suspect? Was it because of his powerful wife? We'll explore this in the next episode when we ask, what's the deal with Gretchen Tiegler?
Do you love to cook but rarely find the time? Our sponsor's Fast and Fresh.
The episode ended as we reached the top of the loch. The music rose and fell as we drove along a straight road through a forest of pines. I turned the fog lights on, cutting through the pitch dark, turning the road ahead into a grainy computer game. Gretchen Tiegler paid Sabina off. It seemed impossible that someone could get away with all of this, do all of this, walk around and breathe and marry and shop and do all of this. And Hamish was in Porto with Estelle, and I wasn't going to live with my girls anymore, and my picture was on Twitter with my door in the background, my front fucking door where my kids lived, where a fire could happen, a suspicious house fire. I was driving faster and faster.
Anna, I think we need to talk.
Shut up!
Why are you driving so fast? Where are we going?
Adam!
I don't know if you're safe to drive.
Fuck off! Fuck right off! I can't
quite recall what happened then. The road went blurry, and there was a crunch, a skid, and a loud bump, and the car stopped moving forward. It gave out a grinding growl.
I looked over. Finn Cohen's body was slumped over the dashboard, but his face was missing. I had killed him.